Ready?
So we're still a little, not totally filled up yet. Okay. Anyway, I wanted to go back a little bit. The parsha that we'll be reading is Acharei Mos. And Acharei Mos literally means after the death of the two children of Aaron. So remember the chronology here. It's been a little bit less than 1 year since we left Mitzrayim. We left Mitzrayim on the 15th of Nisan. And in that year, there was a lot of things that happened. There was Matan Torah, there was the Chet HaEgel. And we finally come to the building of the Mishkan. Now, the Mishkan was dedicated on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Now, in the Torah, Rosh Chodesh Nisan is always a new year, right? So until Rosh Chodesh Nisan is the first year of the Exodus, and Rosh Chodesh Nisan is the second year. From the 23rd of Adar till Rosh Chodesh Nisan, this is called the 7 days of Miluim, the 7 days of consecration or preparation. Every single day during those 7 days, Moshe Rabbeinu would put up the Mishkan, take it down, put it up, take it down. And for those 7 days, Moshe Rabbeinu brought all the korbanos. Moshe was the Kohen, and Moshe was bringing korbanos to atone for Aaron and his sons, that they should be worthy of doing the avodah. Finally, we have the eighth day. Now, the eighth day, which is last week's parsha, the eighth day is Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Rosh Chodesh Nisan is the dedication of the Mishkan. And what happened on the eighth day was that Aaron and the other Kohanim, for the very first time, were authorized to bring the korbanos. Okay, so Aaron entered into the position of Kohen Gadol on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Yeah.
Was it that was it that this point in time was that the firstborns were the Kohanim, or what? And but because that would, I would ask, why was Moshe doing it instead of Aaron still?
Yes, it's a little tricky, because the firstborn actually became disqualified with the Chet HaEgel.
Oh, okay.
So between the Chet HaEgel and the Hakamas HaMishkan, you kind of have a no man's land
in which
Moshe Rabbeinu took over until, in other words, it was designated to go to Aaron, but Aaron was not yet ready, particularly because of his role in the Chet HaEgel himself, until Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So at that point, Moshe Rabbeinu was the transitional Kohen. The Bechor was already puzzled from the Chet HaEgel. Okay, so Aaron has four children. Aaron has four sons, Nadav, Avihu, Elazar, and Issachar, right? These are the four sons of Aaron. So altogether, there's only five Kohanim around. Although it's not clear, because Elazar's son is Pinchas, who becomes very prominent later in the Torah. So Pinchas was already born, but he was not yet acting as a Kohen. And the Torah records that Nadav and Avihu took a foreign fire into the Mishkan, for which they were not commanded. And it says, a fire came out of Hashem, it entered into their bodies, and destroyed them. And Chazal understand that this is what is called Serefas Neshama V'Guf Kayim, meaning their neshamas were burnt, but their bodies were intact, meaning it was kind of a fire that went into their nostrils, consumed them from the inside, but their bodies and their clothing were intact. If you would have looked at it, the bodies looked 100% fine. And this was the tragic deaths of Nadav and Avihu. And the Torah records that Vayidam Aaron, that Aaron's response was silence. Aaron did not complain, he did not criticize, and the like. Now, Acharei Mos are the mitzvos that were given after the death of Aaron, of Nadav and Avihu. But I want to focus a little backwards, because this was really right after Pesach in Eretz Yisrael, we read Parshas Shmini, so I wasn't here to talk about that. So I want to backtrack a little bit. Exactly what was the sin of Nadav and Avihu? Why did they die? Like, what was it? They were great, great tzaddikim. So the Torah itself says they brought a foreign fire. And yet, Rashi brings a whole bunch of reasons that have nothing to do with a foreign fire. One interpretation that is given is that they entered the Mishkan after drinking some wine or intoxicating beverage, and one is not allowed to enter the Mishkan or later the Beis HaMikdash once you've drunk. And it doesn't mean you have to be drunk. Even if you just drank a revius, just 4 ounces of wine, you're not allowed to enter the Beis HaMikdash until the wine dissipates and the like. And where does Rashi get that? Because right after Nadav and Avihu died, Hashem commanded Moshe and Aaron that never, never enter the Beis HaMikdash or the Mishkan or the holy place when you're in a state of intoxication or drinking wine. Now, of course, that itself raises a fascinating question. You know, in the American Constitution, there is a rule that the government is not allowed to pass what is called an ex post facto law. Now, an ex post facto law means a law that is passed criminalizing what you did after you already did it. Let's say I did something that was okay. The government now wants to pass a law. By the way, anyone that ever did this, you know, can go to jail. Can't do that because at the time I did it, it wasn't a crime. I mean, what are you saying? Nadav and Avihu get killed because they violate the halacha of drinking wine, which was not given to Bnei Yisrael till after Nadav and Avihu died. How could Nadav and Avihu get punished for doing something that was not yet prohibited when they did it? It was prohibited after they did it. But that itself is not so much of a kasha, because one might answer that Nadav and Avihu were on such a high madrega that they should have understood that something was improper even before Hashem gave the commandment. Meaning we need to be given the commandment. We might not have figured it out ourselves. They should have figured it out themselves. And indeed, a tzaddik might be held accountable for what he should have figured out even in the absence of an actual command. So that's reason number one, shasui yayin. There are other reasons. Another reason is they didn't want to get married, so they didn't fulfill Prairie of Arivia. That's reason number two. Reason number three, these are all in different midrashim. Reason number three is they were Mayra Halacha Bifnei Moshe V'Aaron. Meaning to say that when people would ask Shilas to Moshe or Aaron, Nadav and Avihu would paskin. And you're not supposed to paskin in the presence of your Rebbe, unless your Rebbe gives you permission. Right? And if you're Mora Halacha Bifnei Rabbi, you're Chayav Misa. In fact, let me tell you that according to the Gemara, not only are you not allowed to paskin in the presence of your Rebbe, but you're not even allowed to paskin in a certain geographic proximity to your Rebbe without your Rebbe's rishus. And the secret I'll tell you is, this is the meaning of ordination today. You know, a person that's a rabbi gets something called smicha. Now, without giving away any secrets, I just want to tell you that all of us that have smicha, we are fake. We don't have real smicha. Our smichas are all fake, because real smicha is unbroken ordination, going all the way back from Moshe Rabbeinu. And when you have real smicha, you can have a Sanhedrin, and you can even paskin dinei nefashos and all of those different things. Sometime in Roman times, the chain was broken, and the last person that had smicha did not convey it to somebody else. So bizman hazeh, we do not have smicha. That's why we don't have a Sanhedrin. If we had smicha, we could have a Sanhedrin, we could do all sorts of things. You don't need a Beis HaMikdash for the Sanhedrin. That's a big mistake. If somebody were to ask you, why can't we have a Sanhedrin of 70? Bizman hazeh, so somebody might answer, well, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash yet. That's not the reason. You don't need a Beis HaMikdash for the Sanhedrin, but you need smicha for the Sanhedrin, and we do not have unbroken smicha. So now, how will we get it back? We will get it back because Eliyahu HaNavi is going to announce the coming of smicha, of Mashiach. Eliyahu HaNavi never died. Eliyahu HaNavi has smicha, and he will be able to give smicha to the qualified people of the generation, and then we will have a Sanhedrin, and once we have a Sanhedrin, we can do all sorts of things. We will sanctify the new moon through testimony instead of a calendar. We can make takonos, we can make gezeros. In fact, I'll give you an interesting example. A Sanhedrin, in theory, could be mevatel the chiyuv of keeping 2 days of Yom Tov in Chutz Laaretz because of email and because of instantaneous communication. Wow. They would have that power. We don't have that power because once Chazal made a takana, we don't have the koach to be mevatel, but a Sanhedrin would have that koach. As an aside, this is just a digression, there is a passage in the Rambam that implies that if most of the Chachamim of Klal Yisrael were to decide to recreate Smicha, they could create it Yesh Me'ayin. They could create it without an unbroken tradition. I think it's a question of what the Rambam means. And in the 1500s, there were some Shitas that wanted to recreate Smicha. There was a great Gadol in Tzfat, who was the Beis Yosef's Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Beirav, who actually felt that if all the Chachamim agreed, he could create Smicha, and he got the agreement of most of the Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael, not all, that was part of the problem, not everybody agreed, and he actually gave Smicha to four Talmidim, real Smicha, to four Talmidim, Rav Yosef Karo, Rav Moshe Alshich, the Mabit, Rav Moshe Ben Yosef, and Rav Moshe Galanti. Now, Rav Yosef Karo, of course, is the author of the Shulchan Aruch. He kind of wrote the book that you test a person on. So, he got smicha. And the Alshich was a very famous darshan and posek. All of them have their own shuls and svat. The Mabit was the Beis Yosef's chaver. Rav Moshe Galanti is the least known of the four, but he must have been a very great person, given the fact that he got smicha along with those four. But there was so much controversy. The Chachmei Yerushalayim did not agree with what they were doing in Tzfat. And as a result, even the four people that got Smicha did not pass it on. So this was a controversy that never got definitively resolved, although the Minhag of Klal Yisrael is not to reinstitute Smicha. So why am I mentioning this? Just as a little aside, so given the fact that a rabbi gets ordained, it is not real ordination. What is the purpose of smicha? So technically, the purpose of smicha simply means that you are given permission to paskin shailas, even if your rebbe is in the same city. Because otherwise, you're not allowed to paskin a shaila in the city of your rebbe without his permission, right? So that's technically what smicha does, that you're given permission. Now, according to the Medrash, the sin of Nadav and Aviyu, right? So we have a whole catalog of sins. One is, as they say, they drank wine before they entered the Mishkan. Number two is they didn't get married. Number three, they would paskin halacha in front of Moshe and Aaron without asking permission. You had a hand up?
Sorry, their own questions also they couldn't paskin?
No, they can ask their own questions, but they can't communicate a psak. If they have a shaila, they don't have to ask. But if someone asks them, they're supposed to say, "You have to ask my rebbe," unless they have permission from their rebbe. Okay. Yeah.
So I asked the rabbi on Shabbos about whether you can eat after.
After shtia.
I'm not technically. I have to ask rabbi if I could tell somebody else that answer that you.
Technically, yeah, but I'll tell you ahead of time that you have my blanket permission. You don't need to ask every. You don't need to ask every time. I'll give you smicha for that purpose. Okay. Although I also want to tell you another thing. There is some question when I say all of these things need definitions. You're not allowed to paskin in front of your rebbe, okay, or in the city of your rebbe. The question becomes: what do we mean by your rebbe? The term Rebbe, who is your teacher, is a very, very unclear term. On one hand, Pirkei Avos says, even if you learned only one line from somebody, he's your Rebbe. Well, but that's pretty extreme here. I mean, let's say, you learned like one line from somebody in the center. That means every time you're asked a shaila, you know, you've got to run. So for this purpose, we mean by Rebbe, and that's why some Rebbe may not be right. So Rebbe, it's someone that you learned most of your knowledge of Torah from. So in many cases, you may not even have a single Rebbe that would qualify for that definition, because if I learned, let's say, 15% here, and 15% here, and 15% here, 15% here, I don't have what is called Rabo Mufak, right? So it's not always so clear, but it's good to be strict on this. For the kavod of your Rebbe, it is good to be strict, but as a technical matter, it is not always so pashut who is called Rabbi Mufak for these purposes. Okay, but to go back to our list, because I want to give you a pretty big list. So far we mentioned three, is that right? We mentioned drinking wine, not getting married, paskining halachos in front of Moshe and Aaron. Number four is kind of the same, but it's a little different, and that is that they wanted to be the leaders in Am Yisrael, and they were hoping or saying to themselves, only Hashem knew this, when will these old people, Moshe and Aaron, die so we can take over the leadership? Of course, that's kind of connected to the notion of why they were jumping the gun and paskening halacha in the presence of Moshe and Aaron. So again, I want to keep track of it because I think we're going to come up with seven. So that's four, right? Mentioned four. Okay. Number five is that they were not wearing the proper number of garments that a Kohen has to wear in order to do Avodah, right? There are big day kahuna. A Kohen Gadol wears eight garments, that includes the hat, and a Kohen Hedyot, a regular Kohen, wears four garments. Now these garments are extremely important. If a Kohen does Avodah without wearing the right number of garments, if he's missing one of those garments, he is Chayav Misa. What's interesting is that if he wears extra garments, he's also Chayav Misa. So for example, that means practically, if it's a cold day, remember, the Avoda in the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash is outside, right? The Korbanos are outside, they're not inside the building. The Mizbeach is in a courtyard. So a Kohen cannot wear socks or shoes. A Kohen cannot wear a sweater. A Kohen cannot wear a coat. Because if he wears any of these things, he is wearing an extra garment. And if he's missing a garment, or it's an extra garment, he is Chayav Misa for that. He can only wear the big day kahuna. Yeah.
Would that include a scarf? Because I know we don't like put tzitzis on the scarf, because it doesn't...
Well, it's not a four-cornered garment, but still he would not be allowed to wear a necktie or a scarf or the like. I'll tell you a little story I just read. Somebody was writing that somebody from America brought their child to have a bar mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael. I don't know how they knew Reb Chaim Kanevsky, but... They happened to be Kohanim. So they took their little boy and they introduced him to Reb Chaim Kanevsky for a bracha, for a mazel tov. So Reb Chaim Kanevsky said to the boy, he says, can you see without your glasses? Nobody wore glasses. So the boy said, well, I guess. Reb Chaim Kanevsky took off the boy's glasses and says, can you see me? He says, yeah, I can see you. He says, Baruch Hashem, you can do the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash. Because Reb Chaim said that a Kohen is not allowed to wear glasses in the Beis HaMikdash because that would be an extra garment. So even if it's not that would...
Contacts.
So there are two different... The truth is there are two different halachic issues here. One is it's an extra garment. The other is the possibility that if you can't see well, that might be a blemish, that might be a mum. Mm. See, it's two different considerations. Now, I think the nafkamina might be contacts. Contacts are probably not a garment because it's not, you don't visually see anything. On the other hand, if you have defective eyesight, it may be a mum. So it may depend. I'm not sure which reason Reb Chaim meant. He seemed to say kind of both ideas, but that would be a nafkamina. I think it's true, by the way. I think you cannot be an airline pilot if you... need glasses or contacts, right? So there's a din of a mum for an airline pilot as well in those things. Okay, so that's the five, right? Five. That's the fifth reason. Okay, so now let me give you two more reasons. A sixth reason that the Gemara gives is that in reality, if you remember at Matan Torah, at the end of Parshas Mishpatim, Matan Torah. So it says that the elders of Israel were eating and they gazed at the Shekhinah, they gazed at the divine presence, and they saw a sapphire throne, or they saw a sapphire floor in the sky, as it were, and they saw the throne of Hashem, and they ate and they drank, if you remember that. Now it doesn't say who those people were, but according to the Medrash, it was Dasan and Aviram that were gazing at the Kisei HaKavod. They weren't gazing at Hashem. Hashem you cannot see, but they were gazing at the Kisei HaKavod, and they were doing so without proper respect. They were eating and drinking. In other words, they were Kalos Rosh. And really, they were Chayav Misa at the time of Matan Torah. But Hashem did not want to mar the joy of Matan Torah by killing them then. So Hashem deferred their death sentence until the day of HaKamas HaMishmash. It's also a happy day that Hashem did mar, but he didn't want to mar the simcha of Matan Torah. But thus, but Nadav and Aviyu were actually chayav misa from the time of Matan Torah. Vayechazu eser Elokim, they gazed at God. Vayechlu vayishtim. The seventh reason, the final reason that is given, is that this was a punishment to Aaron. Aaron did participate in the Chedo Egel, right? Remember, Aaron built the Egel, or at least Aaron told the people. Remember, they wanted to build the Egel. They thought Moshe was not coming down. They thought Moshe died. So Aaron was worried. Aaron wanted to buy time. His kavanah was l'shem shemayim, because he thought they would kill him, as they killed Hur. Hur was Miriam's son, and they killed Hur, who protested. And Aaron did not want to be the next one, because there is a special curse if you kill a Navi and a Kohen on the same day. And Hur is a Navi, and Aaron is a Kohen, and therefore Aaron could not allow himself to be killed. So Aaron told people, give me your jewelry, and he thought the men wouldn't do it, but the men did give the gold. Aaron threw it into the fire, and the eagle came out, you know, by itself. So really, Aaron himself was Chayav Misa for his involvement in the Chedo Egel. And because of that, all four of his children should have died. He and his four children. But Moshe Rabbeinu's prayer annulled 50% of the decree. So instead of four children dying, only two of them died. Nadav and Aviyu died as a punishment to Aaron for the Chedo Egel. And even though Aaron had four children, this is an example, the Gemara says, of something called tefila osa mechza. Tefila can annul, sometimes it annuls everything, but in this case, tefila annulled half of the decree. So I gave you no fewer than seven reasons why Aaron's children died. Now, the big problem is this. The Torah itself gives me the reason why they died, and all of these reasons are different than what the Torah says. The Torah gives the reason they brought a foreign fire into the Mishkan, which they were commanded, or which they were not commanded to bring in. Now, if we put aside all these midrashim and we simply ask ourselves, what is the Chumash telling me they specifically did wrong? What aveira did they do wrong? So the simple meaning is this. If you recall in Parsha Shemini, when the Mishkan was finally ready to be dedicated, and there's the Mizbeach, and there's the wood on the Mizbeach, there's not yet a fire. But a fire came down from the Shamayim, and it ignited the wood of the Mizbeach. Now, where do they bring incense? Right, they have two Mizbachos, they have two altars in the Mishkan, as they had in the Beis HaMikdash. The outer Mizbeach, which is big, and that's called the copper Mizbeach, that is where you bring all the korbanos. But inside the Mishkan building, and in the Beis HaMikdash, inside what is called the Heichal, outside of the Kodesh HaKdashim, but in the Heichal, you have the menorah, and you have a much smaller Mizbeach that is made out of gold. And the smaller Mizbeach is not used for korbanos, except on Yom Kippur, we have some sprinkling of blood. But the inner golden Mizbeach is used for Ketores. And Ketores was burnt twice a day, in the morning and in the afternoon. On Yom Kippur, there was an extra one in the Kodesh HaKdashim. But normally, there is Ketores of the morning and Ketores in the afternoon. And Ketores is basically putting incense on coals. Where do you get the coals? Where do you get the fire? So let's take a regular day in the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash. So the halacha is, the Kohen is supposed to take glowing coals from the outer Mizbeach. Right? So he has the glowing coals in his left hand, he has the incense in his right hand. He then goes into the inner Mizbeach, he puts the glowing coals on top of the golden Mizbeach, and then puts the incense on the coals. And even on Yom Kippur, when he goes into the Kodesh HaKdashim, he takes the coals from the outer Mizbeach and he brings it into the Kodesh HaKdashim. Right? Do you understand that? So the halacha basically is that you have to take the fire from the Ketores from the Mizbeach. The Torah says that for whatever reason, Nadav and Aviyu took the glowing coals from the... from on their own. They took it from outside them. That's called a foreign fire. They didn't take it from the Mizbeach, which was the fire coming from heaven. They took their own coals. And that's why they got killed. That's what the Torah says. So what's interesting is, if the Torah says they were chayav misa because of Eish Zara, because of a foreign fire, and that's why they're chayav misa, that's why they died, why do Chazal give us seven other reasons that are not, none of them, are the reason that the Torah itself gives? That's a very strange thing. So the answer has to be that Chazal understands that Eish Zara is not meant to be literal, but rather Eish Zara is a spiritual phenomenon which corresponds to all of these seven, or any one of these seven. And that is the following idea. We know that Eish is often associated with passion, excitement. And a person who serves Hashem should feel like an Eish, right? We talk about, right here, we're in Ar Samech, we're our competitor, but you know, we have Eish HaTorah, the fire. But the truth is, you need Or, you need Eish, right? You have to generate fire as well. And the Torah is called fire in Zeis HaBracha. Mimino, to the right hand of Hashem, Eish Das, is the fiery law. The Torah is described as written in black fire and white fire. That is the primeval Torah that pre-existed 2,000 years before the world was even created. That was the blueprint through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. So passion is a very important thing. A person does not serve Hashem by rote, by boredom, by complacency, with a lack of geshmak. A person serves Hashem with enthusiasm, with passion. That is called the Koach of Eish. And Nadav and Avihu had the Koach of Eish. But there's a certain sakana in the Koach of Eish. And that is, sometimes, when a person's Avodas Hashem is so connected to their enthusiasm, to their passion, to their inner spirituality, they sometimes become impatient with the details of halachic life, because they feel that halachic detail distracts them from the larger picture. Right? You're familiar with this phenomenon. Let's take a simple example. Zman Kriya Shema, right? I don't know what time Zman Kriya Shema is this week. We have our sign up. Anyone happy to know? I mean, Baruch Hashem, we daven before, but let's make up a time. 8:45. Okay. Zman Kriya Shema is 8:45. So let's say you're preparing yourself to daven, and you're meditating, and you're getting yourself into a very, very high, focused, intense level of daven. But you're not going to be ready to say Shema until 9 o'clock, or 9:30, or 10 o'clock. And somebody says, stop, you got to stop your meditations. You got to say the Shema now. Now a person might think, if the ikar point of Avodas Hashem is to have passion and fervor and love and reverence for God, what's the big difference if I say Shema by 8:45 or 8:46? Is that going to make a difference? Or if Chaim Volozhiner gives an extreme example, let's say it's time to make the Seder, and you're dead tired, or your wife is dead tired. You've been cleaning up for weeks and weeks and weeks for Pesach. So you might say to yourself, you know, the whole purpose of the Seder is to relive Yetzias Mitzrayim, to relive the closeness of Hashem. So I'll tell you what, I'll go to sleep early tonight, and tomorrow morning I'm going to make the greatest Seder that you'd ever see. Because if you define your Yiddishkeit in terms of your passion and your geschmack, you might say that some of these halachic details, frankly, don't make sense. What? My Shabbos is going to be hurt if I rip toilet paper or I turn on an electric light? These are details. A spiritual person doesn't have to focus on so many minutiae. Now, by the way, I once gave this... By the way, this was part of Vilna Gaon's disagreement with Hasidus, because Hasidus, the early Hasidic movement, was emphasizing so much the feelings and the passion that there was a certain de-emphasis on halachic detail. Because they were basically saying, these details aren't so important. They don't contribute to my mood. They don't contribute to my feeling. And if anything, they slow me up. They don't allow me to focus on the big picture. To use a fancy English word, therefore, we might say that spirituality has, on some level, a very strong antinomian tendency. A bit of a highfalutin word, but antinomian simply means it is against formal rules. A spiritual person, beteva, tends to be a person who doesn't like to live by definite rules. They like to do those things that give them a feeling of closeness to God. And sometimes specific rules seem to be a hindrance. Now we know, again, this is not what I'm espousing, we know that that's a very big mistake. We know that Hashem can only be served in the way Hashem has said he's to be served. And if you're serving God based on what makes you feel spiritual, you're not really serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're serving yourself. But this is what metaphorically we can call Eish Zara Asher Lo Tzuva Osam, a foreign fire for which they were not commanded. In other words, instead of looking at it literally as they brought in a foreign fire, the Torah is made that what destroyed Dasan V'Aviram was a misplaced passion. They were so holy, they were so elevated, they were so spiritual that they neglected certain details that they were commanded to do because they were focused on a bigger picture. But because that passion was not rooted in the commandments of God, they were destroyed. Because essentially, not because they were wrong, now this is a very controversial idea, as great, great tzaddikim, perhaps they could have their own private deal with God. See, this is something we don't fully understand. It may very well be that there might be people who are so great, so exalted, beyond us, that they can do with Hashem. They have a private arrangement with the Rebbe Baruch Shalom. But God took them away because they can't be the leaders of Am Yisrael. They can't be our role models. They can't be the people we emulate, because we must follow the halachic path, because for us, that is the only way we get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, and that's why Moshe Rabbeinu said, I see how great they are, because they were serving Hashem on a level that was somewhat even independent of the halachic rule. But that is not an avodah for us to follow. And therefore, what I want to suggest is, all seven averos are manifestations of the Eish Zara, of the passion that is so overpowering that it sometimes ignores halakhic restrictions. So let's take it one by one, just very quickly. Drinking the wine. Now, why did they drink wine? They didn't drink wine because they wanted to be drunk. They drank wine because they reasoned, if the purpose of serving Hashem is to open up your feelings, open up your emotions. So just like Yom Purim, right? We take drinks to kind of elevate our consciousness. So they did it the same way a person might take psychedelic mushrooms or LSD or whatever it is. You want to open up. And their kavanah was l'shem shemayim. They wanted to go beyond the narrowness of their normal rational faculties to connect to God in a holistic way. And that sounds good. You know, as you know, there are some religious rites that use psychedelic stimulants as part of their religious worship. And that's what Nadav Navihu did. And it comes from their eish, their passion. But that's not the way Hashem wants us to serve Him, so we can't do that. Or not getting married. They essentially took like a Christian position. They basically said, we serve God by removing ourselves from physical pleasures and from sexual reproduction and the like. We want to be celibate and the like. Again, in many, many religions, that is the notion, which you take that energy that might go into a marital relationship and you give it to God. One could make the case for celibacy in theory, but once again, as logical a case as you can make, that is not the Ratzon Hashem. The very first commandment of Hashem is Pruervu. And perhaps they were led astray because they saw that Moshe Rabbeinu was celibate after Maimed Har Sinai, and they thought that that was a path to Kedusha. But whatever the pshat in Moshe was, that's not something we're supposed to emulate. The notion of paskening halacha in the presence of Moshe and Aaron symbolically could be understood this way. Moshe and Aaron represent the halacha. They wanted to be free of those rules. They wanted to focus on what makes you spiritual. That's what it means, they pasken. And similarly, the idea that they were hoping Moshe and Aaron would die because they would say, we'll replace. They were spiritual anarchists, in a sense, in a high way. Meaning, they basically said, instead of having mechanical rules and regulations, our relationship to Hashem should be based on feeling, emotion, and passion. That is why they said, when will these old folks die so we can replace Judaism with, instead of having rules on halacha, let's focus on what brings a person spiritual. Similarly, not wearing all the clothes. Again, this is a metaphor. Clothing is something that separates us from someone else, right? In other words, you're not connected to the person's body in its entirety. They didn't want a barrier between them and God. They wanted to be totally open, totally exposed. That's why they didn't wear the proper big day kahuna. They didn't want anything to have a barrier. And they say, if Hashem says I have to daven this, I have to say this, I have to do this, that's a barrier. I can't connect to Hashem based on my feeling. Matan Torah, the same thing. They gazed at the Shekhinah. They didn't want the boundaries and the limitations of halacha. And even the Chet HaEgel. The Chet HaEgel came, according to most Mefarshim, because the Jews wanted to make God in their image that they could relate to. They wanted an intermediary. They wanted a tangible connection with God. So the common denominator of all of this is that Nadav and Abihu represented the polarity of spiritual passion. The notion of developing within ourselves a feeling and a yearning of Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. But the tragedy was, it was not bounded by halachic considerations. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, this is a phenomenon that's very, very relevant today. In much of the world, people are looking for spirituality. There is what is called New Age spirituality, where people are looking for ways to feel connected. But often, they want to feel connected by whatever makes them feel good. It's like, whatever makes me feel good is spiritual. And although it's true that we are supposed to develop passion and connection to Hashem, but it has to be within the halachic framework. And when one ignores the halachic framework, then what you think is a spiritual experience is actually a narcissistic experience. It's a self-gratification. It makes me feel good. And that is egotistical. That is really, everything is connected to what makes me feel good, as opposed to genuinely serving Hashem. It is true that in the course of serving Hashem, you should also feel good. That at Be'ezras Hashem, Avodas Hashem should lift you up, should give you simcha. And Hashem wants us to serve Him with simcha. But that is a consequence, meaning to say, the measure of what is Avodas Hashem is not whatever makes you feel happy. Avodas Hashem is objective. But then, if one truly serves Hashem, one will feel simcha. As opposed to saying, it is only those things that make me feel good that are spiritually valuable. And this was the great tragedy of Nadav and Avihu. Again, the thing I want to underscore is, it may very well be, for people of their madrega, their approach was correct. It's not so much that their approach was incorrect, but their approach is not an approach that is something that the rest of Klal Yisrael can emulate, and therefore they were taken from the world because of their kedusha, because that represents a higher madrega than we are capable of living. We need the guidance of halacha. We need the detail of halacha. We cannot be left to our own to figure out how to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Maybe there were tzaddikim that could. In fact, I don't want to get into too many difficulties, because there are a lot of questions I do not have the answer to. But people sometimes ask about great Hasidic Rebbes who miss Zman Kriya Shema, who daven late, who daven Mincha in the middle of the night, and they daven Shacharis in the middle of the day, or even at night, and time is all mixed up, and the like. And people ask the question, how do you know what's going on? And I don't have an answer. But all I can say is that great tzaddikim have their own private connection to Hashem. And they cut their private deal, so to speak. But it's not something that we can emulate. So to me, the kasha is not so much on the Rebbe as it is on the Hasidim. The Rebbe can do what the Rebbe does, but the Hasidim aren't supposed to follow. And then, of course, the question then becomes, so why does the Rebbe do it so that the Hasidim sees what he's doing? Tzarechi and Gadol, I do not have a good answer to that. But I am suggesting that this is similar to the Nadav and Avihu phenomenon, in which they kind of had a private relationship with God, but they were taken because their relationship, which was not necessarily bounded by halacha, is not a relationship we are allowed to have. We cannot have the relationship that they had, and therefore they were taken from the world, not so much as a punishment, but as they're not for us. They're a madrega that's beyond Olam Hazeh, and that is all what Chazal mean by Eish Zara, a foreign passion. So the reasons Chazal are giving are not contradicting the Torah. They are interpreting what the Torah means by Eish Zara. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, so I think that would actually be along the same way, meaning metaphorically what happened to them was exactly what they were experiencing. Their souls were so consumed with love of God that they wanted to transcend the limits of their body, and that's what Hashem gave them. Hashem gave them this death in which their soul just left their body, because that's what they want. They wanted a devekus, but that devekus could not exist in the physical world that we live in.
Do they make kiddush in the temple on Shabbos?
Well, no. They'd have to make. Let me put it this way: if you were a kohen on duty, not every kohen worked every Shabbos, but if you were a kohen on duty on Shabbos, you'd have to hear kiddush from somebody who was not on duty. You could not drink the wine. You could not drink the wine. Now, even today, the one remnant we have two remnants of this halacha. One is that, well, we do have halacha that you're not allowed to daven if you're drunk, but that doesn't disqualify if you had a glass of wine. But a kohen should not duchen. If a kohen drank a revius of wine, he should not duchen until he waited at least a half an hour. Just a revius of wine, etc. So that's important to know. And there actually is a halacha too, that a rav should not paskin a shaila if he drank wine until the wine dissipates. Or liquor as well. And that's why for Sedarim, you know, Pesach night in Europe, people often had chametz shaylas, because they would open the chicken and they would see a little piece of grain in the chicken. All sorts of chametz thick shaylas came up in the Seder. So different Rabbanim had different minhagim, because once they're doing the four cups of wine, they wouldn't be able to paskin. Some rabbis would not begin the Seder till 2 or 3 hours into the night, because in case they were shaylas. But that's keneged halacha, because you're supposed to begin the Seder as soon as it's nightfall. But the Aruch HaShulchan had a minhag that he conducted the Seder super fast, meaning to say he did the Seder within a half an hour. So by the time there would be shaylas already, there'd be a half an hour after the last cup. So he just rushed through the Seder, and in that way he allowed the wine to dissipate by the time the shaylas came in. So those were different minhagim that people had. Okay, see you later.
Thank you, Rabbi.